Accession number 17620, James Watts, Reel 12.
Mr. Watts, Reel 12. We were talking on the last tape about the Monte Cassino, Mr. Watts, and you mentioned the fact that you were there when the bombing raid on the monastery took place, which would be the February.
Yes, I was not actually in positions. We were about 3 miles away at a place called Mignano.
This is before you actually moved.
This is where we were in Lager, because originally, you see, we were going to make the crossing of the Rapido River, over which the 36th Texas Division of the American 5th Army had failed. We were going to do that.
Yeah, we've got that on tape.
Yeah.
What was the average British infantryman's views of the monastery itself and the bombing of it?
Well, most of us were infantrymen who perhaps didn't want to be infantrymen, but were there for a purpose. And we were all military-minded. I think myself that there was a certain decivilization creeping into our being, you know, because all we were doing was eating and sleeping, militarism. And when we watched, we could see it quite clearly. We watched the devastation created by the bombing of, hundreds of bombers. That if that was going to remove the enemy, all well and good.
Had you a view, I know at this time you said you were some 3 miles back, but obviously you did get close later. Was there a view that the monastery was used by the enemy?
Well, I think it would be hard for anyone at that time, without the benefit of hindsight, for to look at that monastery and not realise that somebody was watching you. If he wasn't in the monastery, he was in part in places beside the monastery. And a commander, it's like on a spur, like a V, and the road goes up to about three miles long, direct line more or less, and then when it comes to the V, V is off to the left and up to Rome. That's the road. And of course, it was just there. And the idea was that we try and get round the back of it. Now, the French, I think, was General Juan. If he had been given free rein, I think he would have gone more or less from the northeast part of, and come round the back of Cassino. But the general of the 4th Indian Division, Tucker, he apparently went off down to Naples and he looked through the library there and he examined volumes on what had happened before with our presence. I mean, we're going back a thousand years. And he sorted everything out. And of course, he was in favour of the monastery being raised. And he put this to one of the senior officers, I mean, I think it was Maitland Woolston or somebody like that. And that was it. The bombers went in and destroyed the monastery.
Was the British infantry soldier on those hills, was he for that?
Oh, I think so. Oh, definitely we were. Anything which represented something, it looked so formidable and strong, you know. But as we come to realise later, in destroying it, the Germans could be better fortified. They could use the caves and the rubble and the crypts and whatever it is to good effect. But I think myself, none of my old pals that I know would dispute that the German soldiers who were there were magnificent.
Well, as you were moving forward up to take your own positions on the hills around the casino, the monastery, What were you seeing? Because there had been two or three very severe and savage battles prior to your arrival, had there not?
That's right. The American 34th Infantry Division, they had gone in and they'd done remarkably well. They almost conquered their monastery. They had units of Japanese soldiers, I think I mentioned that before. And then the New Zealanders and the 4th Indian Division, they went in to attack. I think the New Zealanders went in first and failed, and then the 4th Indian went in similar fashion. I don't know which one went before the other, but I do know that the messages were coming through that the New Zealanders were in the Continental Hotel and the Gurkhas were on Hangman's Hill, which was not far from the monastery, fighting back to back. But they were cut off and had to be supplied by aerial drop, you know. So that at that point it was decided to break off the engagement. I think that was two battles. So we went in to relieve the 4th Indian Division, the Royal Sussex Regiment, which is a British regiment, of course. We went in there, and our position was merely to hold until they decided the fresh attack. Of course, that followed later on, I think it was May the 11th.
As you were moving in, what were you seeing? Were there a lot of dead around?
Yes, yes.
What sights were you actually seeing? Because it was pretty grim.
Well, you know, we watched Casino being destroyed, and it was like something out of a horror movie. There wasn't any houses left and everything was destroyed, but we moved in to the right of the casino town, and we went past tanks on the side of the road, British as well as German, and there was all the usual blown bridges, you know, even little small stone bridges across stream, because there it's the confluence of the Rapido and the Liri, and they eventually join and makes quite an area of water. And the bombing had also damaged the strata in the casino area, which made the flooding worse.
And what were the ground conditions like?
Very, very wet. Very, very wet. And the roads were almost impassable. They weren't very good roads. And there was, from where we were in Lager, in Mignano, there was a supply route, and it was camouflaged nearly all the way for 3 miles. And we would, the supplies would come up by 3-tonner, dropped off, transferred to 1,500 weight, transferred to jeeps, transferred to mules, transferred to human porters. And that was the system how we got supplied.
How deep was the mud that you were ploughing through?
Well, in the valley, there was quite a lot of mud. But as soon as we got to the foothills, of course, there wasn't any soil to make mud. It was just hillside, rocks.
Well, that must have been difficult to climb with slippiness. And,
well, you know, no. There was pathways up. Remember, there'd been people there before us. You know, you soon wear a track. You soon wear a track when you go up the hill. But we went into a natural basin, and I went to sleep.
Was this a nighttime relief?
Yes, nighttime. Or you couldn't move during the day. You're under fire all the time if you tried to move during the day. And it snowed, and I remember waking up, and there was a lot of snow, but the snow was on us. And then, of course, we moved into the forward positions, and our positions were probably the most forward of any. We were only about 1,000 yards from the monastery, but about 50 yards away from the enemy.
And 50 yards away, what kind of positions was he holding? Were they above you or level with you?
Well, we were surrounded on three sides.
So you were in a kind of a salient.
We see, that's right. The behind us was Monte Cairo, on which Germany had the Germans still possessed, and they had all their OPs there, and then it came round in a circle into the monastery. It was all American names like Snake's Head Gulch and Dry Man's Gulch, you know, Death's Head so and so.
What was the name of the position you were on? Did it have a name?
It was Hill 495, I think it was. There was another hill, it was called Belvedere. I think that was 593. And there'd been a lot of fighting for that, to get that hill, because that was overlooking us. But for most of the time, we weren't on it, and they could see us.
So you're in a forward position, and ahead of you some 50 yards are the Germans. Where were they? Was it downhill and back up again? What kind?
No, we were on the hill itself. We were on one top, one side, and they were just over the other side on the way to the monastery.
On the same hill?
That's right, and we only had barbed wire, dannet wire in front in about three tiers.
Any mines?
Well, I never came across mines. As I said before, that when I took a patrol, I went through the wire. But I do know that in a previous attack, the Gurkhas had gone in, and they'd gone, and when the machine guns opened up, the lads had ran to some bushes for cover, but the bushes were laced with barbed wire as well, and they were hung on the wires. And that's how they met the end, you know, that tragic lad.
Were the German positions wired in ahead of you?
Yes, yes.
But there were no minefields? No. Mines.
Well, I don't think they could plant mines, you know, not really, because of the rock. You see, we couldn't dig in.
Yes, I was going to ask you, you know, what kind of shelter either was there for you when you got there, or you made yourself?
Well, I don't know whether you're conversant or not, but you have a slit trench. That's just a shallow hollow in which you can hide. You know, as long as you're below the level of the ground, you can escape small arms fire. Mortar fire and shell fire, if you dig a slit trench about 3 to 4 feet deep, so that your head's about a foot below the top, if a mortar bomb drops right close, you're pretty safe. You know, it's got to be a direct hit. And now the slit trenches, Americans call them foxholes. And then they used to have things, shelters of any kind, which shelter you from the enemy. They're called dugouts, or they can be called abris, that's French. Now, we built sangars. In other words, we took over the sangars. That's an Indian word. And we used that with rocks. We built them with rocks. Now,
you couldn't dig down at all?
No, you couldn't dig down. We couldn't dig down to bury the lads. There was one or two little spots which we found where we did inter some soldiers. You know, we buried them.
Sangars themselves, you know, again, can you describe a sangar? I know you say it's rocks, but width, height, depth?
Well, in my particular sangar, it was a big boulder, I would say about a yard wide and about 4 feet high. So they built stones around, you know, as many stones as possible. And then over the top would be a bivouac, a tent, some tenting and a bit of camouflage, kept down with stones. If we had bombing and shelling and there was any decent stones, well, we just added them to the sides of the sangar. I don't like talking about things like this, because you know people think you're shooting the line, but I've actually had a mortar bomb, and that would be an 81mm bomb, drop about a yard away from my sangar, and I felt nothing. I mean, the hole was there. You know, Dutton blasted a huge hole, you know, there was a hole there, and I felt a bit of blast, you know, and the noise, of course. You cannot wipe that out. But the slightest movement on our part, and we got machine guns and mortared very, very heavily and quickly, and, of course, hand grenades, titty matches.
Did in building your sangar, or the ones you took over, did you have any kind of built up stonework behind you?
No.
For back blast, you know.
No, well,
immediately behind.
The big boulder was towards the enemy, and I built round, and you more or less slipped over the top of the wall that you'd made to get inside your sangar. Now, when I got in, there was a blanket and a greatcoat had been left behind. The greatcoat had blood on it. And then I decided I would get them out and shake them up a bit. There wasn't any lice, anything like that. I had a visit of a mouse. But in between the blanket and the greatcoat, after I'd been there about 3 weeks, I discovered some chapatis. I had it in a jam, so I ate them, and they were quite rubby, but I ate them. I was hungry.
How many did the sanger hold, your sanger?
Mine, one.
Just yourself?
Two could squeeze in.
And presumably at some distance there would be other sangers with other members?
Yes.
Of your own section?
That's right, yeah.
Can you again describe how far away the nearest one
would be? 2 to 3 yards.
In a similar
2 or 3 yards situation. Away. And you've got to be within earshot, because for most of the time, if we had anything, we couldn't stand up and shout, "Hey, you come here." We used to say, "Hey there, right, listen, so-and-so, what's happening?" And we'd give instructions like that, you see. At night time, of course, you'd get out where exercise your legs. Some of our lads, when the time came for them to be taken out, you know, they had to be carried out, because they were so cramped, the legs had gone stiff.
Had you any particular little exercise in the sangha to keep you from getting to that condition? How do you keep yourself?
Well, being a little man, it was an advantage. You know, if I sat in a slit trench, my kneecaps didn't show up above the top like a big lad would do. You know, I could just curl up inside a gas cape and go to sleep. That's one of the features which I find remarkable when I think back, is that no matter what was going on, I could just go down, just lie down, go to sleep. And it wasn't because I was tired, it was because I'd just say, "I'll go to sleep and forget about it." You know, it was fascinating. There were quite a few of us could do it. Some look, I didn't know how the hell you can sleep like that, you know.
So in fact, being small, you had a certain amount of muscular movement that you could.
Yes, I was small, I was wiry, I was fit. I was very fit, you know. The army had done its job in that respect. Although, I must admit that after landing in Sicily in August 1943, from then on, I wasn't half as fit as I was in England, because of the conditions in which we lived. You see, it wasn't militarism that was upending me, it was Mother Nature, most of the time. You can't live in cold and wet and mud and expect to get away with it. I mean, there's got to be repercussions later on in life. That's why I'm hammering away at a pension, because I think my stomach troubles are due to what happened at places like Casino, where you didn't get the right type of food. I mean, we went for hours without a brew, without a drink even.
I was going to ask you about the food situation. You did mention some food on the last tape.
Yeah.
But you're in a situation in daylight comes, dawn breaks. What was the first thing you did? Was there a stand to?
Oh, well, you all stand to. When you're in the line. Oh, yes, you stand to.
Now, did you have anything for breakfast? What food did you actually have on you which was meant to last you for the day?
Very little food. I mean, you couldn't go to the...
No, this is it. I mean, you're stuck in one place, aren't you? There's no cookhouse,
you see. You eat things like corned beef. Incidentally, the corned beef, the tins, when you finish with them, some of us who had diarrhoea, we would excrete into one of the tins and just throw it away and throw the excrement into the wind, you know. If we stood up, if we tried to go to the for relief ourselves during the daytime, we just got shot, and you just couldn't do that.
So the bodily functions were done in the place with tins or what have you.
Yeah.
And you say there you had you to be careful where you threw your tins.
Well, of course you had. I mean, but those
you weren't throwing them at the Germans, were you?
I tell you what, something, you're talking about throwing things at the German. I remember throwing some hand grenades at them, and they made a very sharp bang, unusual for even the 36 grenade was what we were using. But after a while I thought, they're good hand grenades, them. And when I opened the box, believe it or not, it had on Tuthill Quarries. And you know where Tuthill Quarries are? At Housel, County Durham, about a mile from where I was born. There was the quarries, it was an ammunition factory.
So you had with you, I suppose you might call, basic rations or iron rations, which would get you through the daylight hours.
Corned beef and biscuits and...
What about a drink? What about water?
Water, for the first week or so, water was very, very scarce, but we discovered a well down below in the valley, you know, in the bottom of the hill where we were. But that was quite a problem getting the water from there, because the slightest hint that we were there and we got well mortared.
And that again was a nighttime activity, wasn't it?
Yes.
Go and fill up.
Oh yes, we had to. We couldn't move during the day.
Was that done by sending someone on a kind of a rotor for their turn to go down and bring the water up?
Oh yes, yes, the water detail, yeah. And of course, on two occasions I went back to bring the porters up who were bringing in the rations and the ammunition, etc., you know, as much as they could carry. I would go down to bring them up and take them on the positions and then send them back on the way.
And you describe one of those on the other table when you brought them up, and they scattered when they came. The moon came out.
As soon as I saw the monastery, yeah.
That must have been a problem, of course. Even at night time, where you say there was some movement, but if the moon came out or the moon was out,
what
happened then?
At least the moon, you could find your way better.
But you were all right. But the Germans couldn't see you.
But believe it or not, I know it's macabre, but. We sometimes moved, go left at the dead pole or wherever it was, you know, the dead body and things like that. And that's how we found our way. There was little points, you know, where you couldn't diversify, you know, because if you did, if you wandered off, well, you were likely to get captured or shot or whatever.
Were the trails marked in some way so that you could
see
where
at night? Well, they were worn. And it wasn't very far, you know. I mean, you'd only move about 200 to 300 yards, and then you come to there'd be somebody there. You know, that would be a certain point.
And were these single line tracks?
That's right, in the main, yeah.
Were they dangerous? I mean, in the sense you say wandering off, but there weren't sheer drops on the edges of them, anything like that?
I didn't have a look around and get the chance to see. No, that didn't happen.
Could you take me through a typical day out on that hillside? We've mentioned that there was a standstill. What time would you be, in effect, be awake or be wakened to start the day's activities?
Oh, about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Now, you're a sergeant in charge of a section, is that right?
No, a corporal.
You're a corporal at this point in time.
Yes.
But you have your own section.
Yes.
Now, can you take me through a day... from that moment that you, in effect, are woken up or wake up, to what would happen on that mountain, on that hill?
Yeah, well, you would have something to maybe to drink or to eat. I mean, we did have, after a while, we got these little Tommy cookers. It's a small tin, and you put like a white... like when you put in toilets, you know, something like that, a white little blob, and you put that in the tommy cooker and put your mist in with the water, and it would give you enough water for a brew of tea. And then we'd have some biscuits and tins of anything that were available. We'd eat rice puddings.
And that would have been brought up at night for you?
Well, there again, you see, that comes back to the compo rations. They were very, very good. But you know, when I come to think, food wasn't on my mind throughout that period I was there. I remember the prune fritters and the apricot fritters and the corned beef pasties, which came up warm, and they'd been wrapped in papers, etc., to keep them warm, you know, put in containers. The cooks must have done marvellous, but... keep us going with something.
That was your major meal, was it, of that day? And would that be taken at night when it was dark?
About 10 o'clock. Because it's got to be cooked, and then it's got to be brought forward, you know, right from the re-echelon, right the way through. And It was a wonder we got anything to eat at all. But
I think we did talk about how important a nice, good hot meal was to you.
Oh, it is. It bucks you up.
So on a morning, you would wake, you would have your breakfast, whatever it was.
Look around, see if everybody was all right. If there'd been a quiet night, you weren't so worried. But if we'd been shelled or mortar or anything like that, and then, of course, it would come out that somebody had been killed or wounded. And one particular night, when the morning came, there was two or three lads, and I think I told you how that we got them out, and the Germans had machine gunned the pathway out.
The stretcher bearers brought them out.
But the 33 days was a very, very, very long time. But to describe one day from different from the other, well, there's no difference. It's just the monotony.
Well, this is it. I'm really looking at the. I quite take the point that one day would be the same as the other, and it's to get that day.
Yes.
So that
eventually you're going to get relieved.
Yeah. So after breakfast, as you say, or at least when light came, you couldn't move. I assume so. You had to shout to each
That's
family.
It.
You
That's
weren't
right.
out wandering around to see if everybody was all right.
That's right. Yes. I used to sit in that hole, and I used to say to myself, what am I doing here? I used to ask myself questions, think a lot. You've got bags of time to think. I wasn't frightened as such. If I'd been ordered to attack, I would have gone over the top, the same as everybody else, you know, and I'd done my best. But just to sit in that hole and take what was being thrown at you, not only by the enemy, but by our lot if necessary, that to me was beginning to gnaw at me very, very much. And although physically I was able enough, it was beginning to affect me mentally, you know, because I didn't see the purpose of it all.
And of course, you couldn't move from it.
No, you couldn't. I would have had to be a very, very, very brave man for to have run away.
Was this usual for most of your colleagues, your comrades?
I think probably everybody feels the same way, because I had a word with the company commander later on those positions when I told him that when we left, and I got back to the valley, I was going to revert to Fusilier. And he said that he depended on the likes of me, you know, for getting things done. And he says, everybody's frightened. I says, I'm not frightened. And I told him I wasn't frightened. I was just miserable, and I just didn't see the point in stopping there and not having a go. And he said, he couldn't attack because we were told not to, unless it was in self-defense.
You were in a sangar, as you say, on your own. So there was that loneliness element in it. Although
That's
someone
it.
Wasn't far away, you
That's
were still
it.
On your own.
That's it.
And this was getting to you, you say.
But having just said that about the company commander, he was on his own totally. You know, it was quite a job.
Where would his position be in relation to your own?
Well, the three platoons are right in a circle, and he's midway about 20 yards, 30 yards away in his abri. You know.
In a central position.
Yeah, that's right. And
was it two platoons up on the front itself and two immediately behind? Was that the?
I can't tell you. I can't remember that. I can tell you the names of nearly all the lads that were in close proximity. You know, I usually go through them alphabetically.
And they were.
Oh, I couldn't tell you them all. I mean, the nearest lads were Curzon, Ryden, Barlow, Seddon, Allsburg, Jones, Bebb, Twine, Lofty, Curzon. Now I've told Curzon, another little lad.
Most of these would be in your section, were they?
They were in the platoon.
In the platoon.
But we only had, whereas the platoon is normally about 28 strong, I think we only had about 16, 17.
Who was the platoon officer on the hill?
Lieutenant He was out of the West Yorkshire Regiment. I think it was a Lieutenant Jones, a schoolmaster. And he got shot in the hand. I didn't know him long, and then he was off. He was gone. We got, whilst we were there, we got an officer from the guards, from the Irish guards, and at night time he goes all on parade and he examined us and he complained about us having corned beef in our ammunition pouches instead of ammunition.